Sunday evening, and Voice of Barbados usually engages in the Better Health Radio Show at this time, and this Sunday is no different. We've got Dr. Adanna Grandison. She's ready and waiting to take you through another edition of the Better Health Radio Show, and as usual, she has her guest, and she will introduce that guest to you as soon as she says hello to you. Good evening, Doctor. How are you doing?
Good evening. Good evening, Gregson, and good evening to our listeners across Barbados this evening. I want to say once again, thanks for having us back another weekend. And this week is no different. I'm bringing to you another speaker who will be really getting down to the nuts and bolts of a topic, which I know, not I think, I know is quite topical in Barbados and certainly has a lot of questions and sometimes misconceptions surrounding such. So I am going to take this opportunity at this time to introduce you to Dr. Nina Yap. Dr. Nina Yap is a newly appointed consultant in vascular surgery at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. She recently returned from Melbourne in Australia after completing a two-year fellowship in vascular and endovascular surgery. She's worked in the Department of Surgery at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital for the past 12 years. And her main area of focus and specialty is lower limb preservation in patients, with the topic for this evening, peripheral vascular or arterial disease. Dr. Yap, I want to start this evening by saying, first of all, thank you. I know you're very, very busy. So thanks so much for actually coming and sitting down and having this chat with us and really enlightening the public of Barbados.
Hey, Dr. Grandison, thank you so much. Hi, Greg. So it's great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a really great opportunity to chat with you all, as well as the wider audience, about a really important topic that I think affects the majority of our population.
Thanks. Well, before we start, I just want to let our listeners know that if you are interested in calling in and asking Dr. Yap any questions, you can call us at 434-1790. That's 434-1790. Or if you don't want to call in, but you still want to have your question answered, you can WhatsApp us at 266-4862. Again, that's 266-4862. Dr. Yap, when we speak about peripheral arterial disease, general public tends to know it as poor circulation. So can you first explain to us really what is this and what causes it? What is really the root behind all that is happening in this pathology?
Thanks, Adanna. I think that's a really great question, because the majority of patients I see will come and say that they're told they have poor circulation, or sometimes the opposite, that their circulation is okay. What it really is a blockage or near full blockage of the arteries. It affects all of the arteries in our body, especially as we all age. It can go from the arteries in the heart, in the brain, the eyes, the arms, but particularly what's really important for our population is the ones that affect the legs, from the thighs to the legs and to the feet and to the toes. And so poor circulation is almost a trigger word for our population. And when sometimes I tell people that they have poor circulation, they immediately jump to their ultimate fears. Could this lead to something fairly major? Yeah. And it essentially the word for it is atherosclerosis, which is a buildup of calcium in our arteries. And that starts when we're very little. It starts from age 10, to be very frank with you. And it's a process that goes over time. And it really comes to play when there's a problem, usually with a part of the body. Like in the heart, it can come about as in a heart attack or a mild angina or something like that. In the brain, it can come up as a stroke. For the legs, it comes up as cramping in the beginning. And then when it gets pretty bad, you can have a wound or an ulcer or tissue loss. And those things are almost always due to some form of buildup of blockage in those arteries supplying those parts of the body.
So, Dr. Yap, I want to take this opportunity because you said that it is a buildup of calcium in the vessels. And that buildup essentially sort of blocks the pathway for the blood to be able to access the tissues in the lower leg, so that those tissues and the muscles within the lower leg essentially receive the nutrition that they require. Who particularly is at risk for developing peripheral arterial disease?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's just to go back as well, it's a lack of nutrition and more importantly, also oxygen. And so when you do have something wrong with that area, You don't have the oxygen to take the nutrients to heal it. People who are who are really prone to it are older. From the time you're probably 50 or 60, you have arthrosclerosis pretty well building up into your into those arteries. Hypertensive patients, so patients with high blood pressure, patients with diabetes mellitus, smokers also as well, and patients with high cholesterol. So when you're talking about those things I've mentioned, high blood sugar, high blood pressure, cholesterol, and a smoker, you're talking about the majority of patients that probably both you and I see in everyday practice. Yeah. And so that's almost the majority of patients that we see. There are some conditions that are congenital, so you might be a relatively healthy person, but you still have a buildup of calcium. And so some of that can be genetic, for sure. There's a lot of Asian populations that, despite the relatively healthy eating habits, they still have early calcium deposits. But what is very interesting is the Black Barbadian population has a very genetic predisposition to very heavy buildup of calcium in their arteries from their kidneys, which is why a lot of patients might have what we call kidney failure or end up on dialysis. And they also have it that, that's why we have see so many lower limb or foot problems in Barbados. So I have many patients that come to me and they do really well with their medication, with their lifestyle modification. They're trying to eat better. They're taking all of their medicines and a lot of things are still happening. And I try to reassure them that sometimes the genetics are playing against them. So I don't always want them to blame themselves for everything that's going on because there is a big genetic predisposition in the population that we have on the island.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Yap, you stated earlier when you first introduced the topic that peripheral arterial disease can present with some symptoms. So I wanted to really get to the bottom of what are some of the, first of all, some of the soft signs, even before maybe that cramping that you spoke about a patient may get, so that we can really start to pay a bit more attention to our lower limbs. Because I know in Barbadian terms, anything below the hip is a foot. But you quite nicely pointed out to us, yes, we have the thighs, we have the leg, which is between the knee and the ankle, and then certainly the anatomical foot, what we call the anatomical foot in medicine. But tell us some of those early signs that we can see even before that patient may develop cramping.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think when patients are coming to me, always I work at the hospital, so they're coming to me not like as a GP in the polyclinic or as a primary care physician. And sometimes one of the things they'll ask me is, why was this not picked up before? But the truth is, it is really quite subtle and silent in the beginning of our years. So from 10 to maybe age 40 or 50, you could be fine. And there really could be no real sign. And so I often reassure patients that, listen, doesn't mean that you did anything wrong or the doctor you were going to missed anything. What we call claudication, which is the leg cramps you alluded to, are actually one of the earlier signs. So when a patient is walking and they're walking, let's say, from one bus stop to the next bus stop every day, and they realize that as the years go, that walk is getting more and more difficult and their legs are tiring and they have to sit down in between or stop in between, let that pain subside, and then restart. That is a very hallmark sign of peripheral arterial or peripheral vascular disease. So it's walking the same distance every time, and the pain comes on, and when you stop, it eases off, and then when you start back, it restarts. So it has to be reproducible, repeatable pain. It's one of the main things I tell primary care physicians to look out for. And you have to give the patient, you know, almost like a known distance. You know, how is it that when you walk to your neighbor or down the street, and they'll say, you know, a few years ago that was easy, and now my legs are really giving out on me. So to be honest with you, before claudication or the cramping, there are not very many signs. Having a history of diabetes and high blood pressure, as difficult as it sounds, if you're coming from a family that unfortunately has had an amputation of the leg, those tell you already that your family history has, unfortunately, a high risk for arthrosclerosis or calcium buildup. So those are important things to tell your general practitioners and in polyclinics. I do not work in a polyclinic anymore. Obviously, I'm a hospital doctor. But one of the things I think is so important, and I've got on calls from many GPs who are just so on it, and they'll say, no, there's no real wound here. There's no ulcer. this patient is okay to me, but I can tell their legs are cramping. And for me, that's actually a pretty early referral. I don't really get to see those kind of patients in the hospital setting. Usually, unfortunately, see them much later. So really keen GPs will pick up that, no, this is something that's going on here. This patient 2 years ago was fine, and now they're having the leg cramps. The other thing that can come on is pain at night. When the patient, it's actually more of a later sign, to be honest with you, the patient will have what we call night pain or nocturnal rest pain. So even if they're doing nothing and they're just lying in the bed, older patients will tell me that they have to get up, sit up out of bed, hang their feet down for a little while to get some relief. And then they can lie back down and go to sleep. But they have to do that maybe once or twice or several times a night. That is the muscles in the leg and lower down, basically screaming for oxygen. And by hanging the legs over their bed or sitting up in a chair and sleeping in the chair, the legs are getting the oxygen from the gravity running down, basically from the dependency. And that's how they get a little bit of oxygen and nutrients to their leg. So cramping and walking the same distance all the time, night pains that you realize are just not what they were a couple of years ago. They were fine, and now you're having night pains. And a strong family history of what you might think as either kidney disease or strokes are caused from calcium blocking the arteries to the brain. Or unfortunately, patients have had family members that have to lose toes or worse or higher. But to be very frank with you, every patient I've ever had to do a procedure on says, could this have been picked up when I was age 20 or 30? And the difficult answer in that is probably not, to be very frank.
Right. And I'm really glad that you put in a plug there for family history, because quite often, sometimes we're a bit embarrassed to talk about our family history. And so it's really important to be able to share amongst your relatives, hey, I recently was diagnosed with something, especially for your offspring, to allow them to know this is probably something that you should be on the lookout for as you get older. Because there is a possibility, especially for those things that have a genetic predisposition, that you may possibly develop it. At this point in time, I just want to remind our audience that you can call in at 434-1790, 434-1790, or you can WhatsApp us at 266-4682. Again, that's 266-4682.
Well, now that you've mentioned that, Doctor, I think I see one here. Well, there's one saying good evening to you and your guest, Dr. Yap. And there's another one saying, if there's a high buildup of calcium in the arteries, which contribute to arterial vascular disease, then should we not be taking calcium supplements with vitamin D?
Dr.
Yap?
Oh, that's a really good question. Most patients will ask me that as well. And what I'd say is that your body knows almost with every element how much it is going to absorb. So you could, it's almost one of those things, and I'm not a nutritionist, so I don't want to, broach that too much. But, you know, if you take too much of one vitamin, your body will actually expel what it doesn't need through the urinary system or through passing of urine. And so people will always tell me, should I stop eating things with calcium? What about breaking down calcium? The truth is you can take a lot of calcium, but you will excrete it in the way your body needs, and it will absorb what it needs and pass out the rest. Unfortunately, there are few genetic predispositions that you could have no hypertension or diabetes or not be a smoker, and you will have a buildup of calcium in the body. We don't see those as much in Barbados, luckily. But should we take calcium with vitamin D? Not necessarily. There's been no evidence to show that at this time. And even if you're taking extra calcium, it doesn't necessarily go and build up into your arteries. So a little bit of a misnomer or a misbelief there. So taking in extra calcium, patients will often tell me they wish they had done something different. But again, it's not really from taking in through the mouth and through the food like that. You had a second question there as well, Grayson.
No, that was it. The other one was just saying good evening to you and Dr. Grandison.
Oh, good evening.
Good evening. Dr. Yeah, I wanted to just take that question that was just asked by our listener a step further. What about for that patient that may, for instance, have had a history of kidney stones? Any connection there?
No connection that I know of, to be very frank. Patients will sometimes, to be honest, they never ask me kidney stones specifically, but I can tell you what's a strong correlation with peripheral vascular disease is renal disease or renal failure. And anyone that has a family member in the dialysis unit at the hospital, or I guess even a private dialysis unit in the country, knows that unfortunately a lot of patients are plagued with toe problems or ulcer problems. And for sure, because the arteries of the kidneys are narrowed from the calcium, so the kidneys are not getting enough oxygen and nutrients, the same is happening to the feet. And I often tell patients as well that the same sort of buildup is happening all throughout the body. And that's not to scare anyone or for anyone to be afraid, but it's not just the legs. It usually means a little bit of buildup in the heart, a little buildup in the arteries to the brain. And that's happening to all of us. It is a natural part of aging and a part of the cholesterol process. So one of the things that is important is cholesterol management. And I feel very strongly about that for anyone that has peripheral vascular disease. Even if your cholesterol is thought to be normal, it's been shown that if you have evidence of peripheral vascular disease, that sometimes being on a cholesterol medicine that is good for your body, you don't have any major side effects on, has been shown to help slow the progress of buildup of atherosclerotic plaque. It does not reverse it. The reason I sort of stress that is because I'm very honest with patients about the expectation of medicine and medications. So it doesn't return or regress or, you know, take away time, but it does, has been shown to help slow the progress of buildup of calcium. So almost every patient that has to have a procedure by a vascular surgeon or a vascular unit is on a cholesterol medication, as well as aspirin, which is a blood thinner. There are a lot of different beliefs about aspirin out there. So some people cannot take it for blood thinning reasons if their blood is too thin or they have an ulcer in the stomach. But aspirin is a pretty important medication if you have severe peripheral vascular disease. And so almost every patient as well that I see or I'm doing a procedure on is on aspirin or a similar medication to aspirin called antiplatelet, as well as a cholesterol once they don't have any major side effects against the cholesterol. And so those are two medications that I feel very strong about. It's evidence-based, to be honest. The part which I think is even probably more important is things that you can change as a patient. You can't change your age and you can't change your race. Those are two things that are decided for you from the time you're born. And so they'll always ask me, is there anything you can change? And if you're a smoker, obviously that's pretty obvious, stop smoking. And smoking is a huge, huge factor in peripheral vascular disease. There's some young patients right now in their 40s, mainly male. That's the kind of condition I see. It's called Berger's disease. Fit young males, and the really only thing they have is that they're strong smokers of all sorts of sort of varieties of smoke, and they have peripheral vascular disease, and that's called Berger's disease. They do not have high blood pressure, they do not have diabetes, but they have this other sort of condition that ends up with very similar outcomes as patients that have to have major surgery on their legs and their feet. But the things that you can change is trying to control the diabetes or high blood pressure if you have it. And those are best things done with it. You build a good relationship with a GP that you trust and that you have access to often, and that you go to them and you have these things checked. Because if those things aren't really optimized or as best as they can be, there's nothing really, not just me, but any vascular surgeon or doctor can do what they think is best. But if those things aren't optimized, it's just not going to work best for you as a patient. So controlling your cholesterol, controlling your diabetes, controlling your high blood pressure. And those are what we call, as we all know, lifestyle modifications and making those small changes. But they make all the difference in how much blood is getting to the most needed parts of your body.
All right. Let me just interrupt you here a second, Dr. Grandison. This WhatsApp says, good evening. I'm a diabetic, 44 years old. Also have poor circulation. I have been getting some stinging sensations. They get pain almost every day and night in the joints. Could you help, they ask.
Dr. Yap?
So that's a good question. 44 is quite young. I see 44 as young as probably most doctors. I guess Dan and I are, we know each other for a while. I think 44 is young now. That's how
absolutely
goes. Yeah. So I think 44 is quite young. Poor circulation at 44 is a bit rarer. You usually see it a little bit later on. But the stinging, now most patients will come to both of us probably, Dr. Granis, and say they have stinging in the fingers and the toes. I'm not sure if that's what this particular caller or messenger is mentioning, but that's quite common in diabetes and diabetic neuropathy. When I ask them, well, what do you mean by the stinging? Sometimes they'll say pins and needles. And the pins and needles in the hands and the feet are not usually from the blockage of arteries. They're usually actually from the effects of the diabetes on the nerves, in the finest nerves in the body. And it can actually be quite very painful, and medication is often hard to get the right medication to treat those pins and needles, or what we call paresthesia, or diabetic neuropathy is what that's really called. When you have pains in the joints, I'll be honest, for peripheral or blockage of the arteries, it's not very common in the joints, like as in the hips or the knees or the ankles. I very rarely see pain limited to the joints. It does, I'm not saying it can't happen, but it's usually in the legs and when you grab your calves. So when you, that's where the pain would usually first come in a patient that has claudication, which is that pain that I was talking about, walking between bus stops or walking to your neighbor and you realize that's getting more difficult. So it's usually pain in your calf. It can happen in your buttock sometimes as well, and that's called buttock claudication. But in the joint, I'll be very honest to that caller or the messenger, not usually. Of course, it's hard for me to say over this sort of program if that's for sure, but that my, you know, my gut feeling would say it's not all due to peripheral vascular disease, but it sounds like you said that you have poor circulation, so it sounds like someone has brought that to light. And that's, I'm not sure that's a medical professional that said, you know, you do have poor circulation, but joint pain, not usually. Actually, speaking on that, what I'll do is I'll just bear off for a second. When people say poor circulation, it usually means pulses, or you'll hopefully see lots of doctors in the polyclinic and primary care doctors or your private GP feeling your groin, they'll feel behind the knee, and they'll feel on the top of your foot and on the side of the foot, and that's them feeling for the pulses. And what they're trying to feel for is the pulses actually coming from your heartbeat, from the beat of your heart. They're trying to feel it all the way down by your toes. And if they don't feel the pulses down by the feet, they'll usually make a big bedside, you know, diagnosis, say you think you have poor circulation. And I actually trust that bedside test quite a lot. It's not foolproof, and different doctors might get different things. It's everyone has their own comfort level. But almost every patient I see, if I don't feel pulses in their feet, before I do any tests, whether it's an ultrasound or I do special pressures of the toes, I know that person has an element of blockages of the arteries. So I encourage that whenever diabetics are going to see their GPs in the polyclinics, they're not only checking the feet for any ulcers and checking between the toes, but they're also feeling for the pulses on top of the feet and behind the ankle and also behind the knee, because that's the first sign, I'd say. You might be feeling fine, and it's super important that your GPs are checking for pulses. So I hope that, I know that was a bit, probably a little bit over the place for that particular message. And sorry, I can't give a direct answer, but I think that might be a few different things going on, if I'm being honest.
All right, you're doing fine, because somebody is telling me here, good evening, I have been a patient of Dr. Yap at the QEH. She's not only a great surgeon, but a wonderful person. And they say thanks for all of your good work. So I had to pass that on for you.
Oh, that's very kind. It's good to hear the good. I've only worked at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, so I guess any patient that knows me, they'll know me from the Queen Elizabeth Hospital.
Well, so far so good. So there you go, Dr. Grandison.
Absolutely. I've worked with Dr. Yap as well, and she's a great doctor. So Dr. Yap, I wanted to go on to talk. I always try to put in a special plug for men, simply because we know the evidence shows that men generally will not seek medical intervention until very late. And there is a particular syndrome that comes to mind, especially that we see, certainly only in men, that is associated with peripheral arterial disease. Can you go on to explain some of those very specific symptoms that men can develop so that they need to be on the lookout and say, you know what, I definitely need to possibly go and see a doctor?
Okay. Are you alluding to Laroche syndrome? Sorry.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. Yes,
okay.
Please.
Okay. I want to make sure I'm on point. Okay. Well, first of all, I do agree with you that men are usually less inclined to come to their doctor. And when I see, especially a young male, maybe not for vascular, because I do general surgery as well. When I see a young male coming to ask an emergency, I know that they're in trouble. It takes a lot for a young guy to come to, you know, to hospital and seek attention. So I know that they're not probably on the early stages of their sickness or condition. I have to be honest, I actually probably see more men in my practice at the hospital. I have to be, it might be 50-50. I have found that more mature men are very, very good. The procedures I've done lately have been more on men, and that's just based on the disease and if I could treat it with the sort of surgery that I do. And they are great. They're fantastic with their medication, with their lifestyle changes. They're fantastic. Their follow-ups to me. I'll be honest, and I might get a little bit of backlash. Younger men, like in their 40s, who are chronic, or well, when I say that, I mean current smokers. Those guys are sometimes a little bit more tricky for me to deal with. I can be sometimes soft-hearted, but there's one thing I'm not soft-hearted about is smoking. If I'm going to do a procedure on you, because as soon as I do a procedure on you and you're smoking, it's really going to be no use to you or do any service to you. So I'm pretty tough on smokers, only for their best outcome, to be very frank. The condition specifically that you're talking about is something called the Reese syndrome. And it's made up of, it usually means that there's blockage of the arteries that's supplying our internal organs or our pelvic organs. And in men in particular, it sounds a difficult conversation, but what they'll have is they'll have some cramping in their buttock and usually on one side, and then they'll have actual issues with basically maintaining their sexual function. And I will ask that question quite often. I'll say, how is your sexual function and your ability to have an erection? I hope this is all okay with this.
Yes, that's fine.
All right. And most men will be very shy with me at first and say, no, it's just my buttocks. And if it's just the buttocks and it's not affecting their sexual function, it's difficult actually for me as the medical doctor because it doesn't quite all make sense. And then usually at the second visit, and I'll see them again, I'll examine them again, I'm getting very similar things with their pulses not being there. And I say, you know, again, just remind me your sexual function you have no issues with. And then they will usually then open and say, no, it's hard for me to maintain. Sorry, it's difficult for me to maintain an erection. And that's something called the Reese syndrome. And it means that your arteries, actually not in the toes and the legs, but your arteries in your pelvis have some blockage problems. And it can be quite a difficult condition to treat. But it means that the blockages are so higher up that the symptoms are not in your feet and not in your legs, well, not usually, not majority of the symptoms. Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with you. It is sometimes difficult for me to get that history. And then it takes a few visits. And then when the patient admits some things to me, and smokers as well, not everyone will tell me they're a smoker, but I think it's so important to be upfront with your medical physician, with your GP, with your surgeon. It's so important because it takes away a lot of the guesswork. And I'm sure, as you know, if patients were potentially 100% upfront with you, you could help them 10 times faster.
Absolutely.
And so with young males, they can have blockages of the arteries that are supplying their private organs, in a way, of their pelvic organs. I have to be honest, I haven't, you know, maybe I'm not asking the right questions, or maybe I'm not getting the right or the honest answers. I haven't seen Reese syndrome much here. I've seen it in two young guys, younger guys, 40s and 50s. And yeah, they were treated for Reese syndrome as well. It's a good question though, but I have to be honest, my more mature male patients in the clinics that I see are really fantastic patients, really, really great. And very, very open, very positive, and I have really good professional relationship with it, with all my patients, but I think maybe as men mature, they get a bit more
in tune with healthcare. Maybe. And Gregson, I say we need to really give a man a clap or a pat on the back, because yes, quite often they may neglect their health, which is also important. So Gregson, is that a call that we have, or someone messaging in?
Yes, it's a message here in the form of another question for Dr. Yap. They say, good evening. How does bypass surgery help?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great question. And I don't want to get too technical, but I mean, that's obviously my forte for sure. When people hear bypass surgery, they might automatically think of the heart. So people will say, you know, I've had a heart bypass or a triple bypass, and you'll see people with a scar down their chest. That's not the surgery I do. I do that essentially for the legs, or for the thigh and the leg. So how I explain when I offer a patient a bypass is, it's like if the highway is blocked or if highway 2A is blocked, what do? You take a side road. So the main highway of your artery is blocked with the calcium and the buildup of cholesterol. We need to go from the top of the roundabout where the highway is clear. We need to make a new road, and we need to connect it back to your own road. That's probably a very obviously simplified version. It is big surgery. It's to be taken and gone through and consented as major surgery, just like a heart bypass. Usually to make that side road or that extra road, we use the patient's own vein from their leg and their thigh. It's called the saphenous vein. They use that a lot in medicine, even for the heart bypass as well. Right. So if I got to choose anything to use in the body, I would use the same vein from the same leg and create a new road for the blood to go down, and literally bypassing your blockages, because it's not usually one blockage. And when I tell patients where their blockages are, either by the pictures that you get from an ultrasound scan or from a CAT scan more often or not in these days, they're surprised to hear that it's not just one little area that's a blockage. They're surprised when I tell them almost from their thigh, which again, Dr. Granderson says it's not, you know, everything has an anatomy. So when I tell them it's almost from their groin, all the way down to below their knee, they're so surprised and shocked. But that's how a lot of the calcium is laid out along that highway. It's multiple areas of literally rock, almost like it looks like calcium and limestone when you take it out. And you have to bypass that pretty long segment. And the idea for that is to get more nutrients, like Dr. Granderson said, and more blood and more oxygen to try to either to basically treat whatever the symptom is. So whether it's the cramping that you're having, or whether it's a wound as in an ulcer or tissue loss, which is what I see mostly, to be frank. And since I've been back, I've done bypasses for the wounds because they need to heal and you need to get blood down. And so the bypasses I've done for the patients that can have them are all for ulcers of the foot. It is a major surgery, and anytime I've talked to anyone about it, obviously I want to tell them it's going to go 100% well, but that's not the truth. There are complications to every surgery and risks. So it's a very detailed conversation we go through with every patient about who's going to have a bypass or potentially have a bypass surgery. But in this day and age, what you can also do is endovascular surgery, but I can always talk about that a little bit later if Adana wants, but that's the answers the question. Bypass surgery is making a new road for the blood and the oxygen to get down to try to heal the problem on the foot.
All right. This next question says, Peyronie's disease, does the calcium buildup cause it?
I'm so sorry. I missed that. Peyronie's disease?
Right. And they're asking if the calcium buildup, if that causes it.
I'm showing my ignorance here. Is Peyronie's?
Yes. So Peyronie's, yes. Usually it occurs as a result of scar tissue. So damage, any trauma that the male patient may have had to his sexual organ, which causes scarring to the actual tissue and usually some bending or defect. And that is not usually as a result of calcium in the vessel. But more so I understand why Dr. Yap is actually a bit confused.
Apologies.
She wouldn't be dealing with that certainly on a daily basis, but it is now outside of the vessel and actually in the muscle of the male genitalia. So I understand exactly why Dr. Yap, you were a bit
apologies. I am very quick to always say when it's not my area of expertise, and I thought, my gosh, do I not know of a very common, you know, condition that the artery is blocked by? Because I would say we have to do more reading, Nina. So. So I can say that I am not familiar with it. So I'm then pretty confident that it's not to do with the calcium buildup. But it's good to hear that talking more about male conditions, and these things are always good to bring to light. As Dr. Granderson said, it's important these things are not shied away from or not not talked about or you know, take 3 consultations to bring out both the symptoms. So I'm glad for it to be. I'm learning too. So that's great.
All right. Well, speaking of meals, we've got another meal here for a contribution via the telephone. Good evening, sir.
Good evening to you, Gregston. Dr. Granison, good evening to you and your guest, Dr. Yap.
Good evening.
Yeah, the question is, I've been absorbing all of what is being said and I'm understanding it. I wouldn't say 100% because I'm no medical person by no stretch of the imagination. But I want to ask this question. If all that I'm hearing this evening has, if blood clots is any part of what, or can be developed by any part of what is being explained to us, the public, because I am on blood thinners, and when I hear these kinds of conversations, I always want to know about blood clots. So that is one thing. The other thing is, Dr. Granison, this is for you. I asked Dr. Boyce when she was on this program if she could formulate a program where we could talk about the various things like potassium and all these different things and explain to us what exactly they mean.
I didn't hear you just now, listener. What did you say? A conversation?
No, I was saying that when Dr. Boyce was on this program, I had asked her one time if she can formulate a program where she can get some special guests to explain to us, I don't know, maybe a dietitian, whoever that would be, to explain to us the different things like what is calcium, what is potassium, what, you know, these various things, and exactly what they are and what they mean to the body.
Okay.
And if you take too much, how detrimental, or conversely, how good they can be for the body. But I would be interested in getting an answer to the first question. I will hang up and listen to you, goodly doctors.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for those two questions. I'll comment before I allow Dr. Yap, because I think her explanation is going to be a little bit longer than mine. To that listener, I'm going to say to you, I am going to take the opportunity to find a specialist for you. I already have someone in mind as you were asking that question. I'm going to see if we can get that guest to come on and essentially tell you about, I think what you want to know is more so about micronutrient content on a whole and getting the best out of what you're going to be putting in your body. So I can't promise you that it's going to be within this month or next month, but certainly I will aim to try to get someone to come out and really explain that. Dr. Yap, I'm going to turn over to you.
Thanks, Dr. Granison. Thanks so much to that caller. I'll just say something on that point as well, and so that the caller also feels that I want to let you know that specialists like myself and Dr. Granison, we also have a lot to learn in every topic, and I strongly agree that a nutritionist or you know, someone in that field that knows about those things is so helpful, especially after, let's say, bypass surgery, after really any surgery. The better your body can be and the healthier you will recover better from surgery, from stress, from everything. And so I do think, and I'm not a specialist in that area, and Dr. Granison and I would have had training in it, but it's not training like those specialists that can know it back to front. To the first question you asked, sir, about blood clots, that's a fantastic question. And I actually didn't even think about it for this particular program. Let me start by saying blood clots are usually a different issue or condition altogether than calcium and calcium buildup over time. If you think of it like a slow process that is calcium, and you know, the road slowly getting blocked or a little bit of rocks falling in the middle of the road, a blood clot is usually a very sudden event. And blood clots, when people say blood clots in the leg, it is usually of the other system. So I'm talking about arteries. Blood clots in the legs are usually from the veins, and the veins are what return blood from the feet up to the body, up to the tummy, and all the way up to the heart. Then your heart pumps it out. It's literally the heart is that your pump system. Your heart pumps out blood through the arteries, and your veins return them back to the heart. And it's literally like a continuous pump and circulation system. When people say they have clots in the legs, it can be in either system. The more common system is the vein, and what we call deep vein thrombosis, or DVT. And there are a lot of patients that have had clots in those systems. So either from a long airplane flight or from sitting down from the job they do, or sometimes, honestly, it can just happen with no known reason. Sometimes they have a condition that forms blood clots a bit faster than other people, and they're usually on a blood thinner, and they're usually seeing a blood specialist called a hematologist. And so that's a different form of blood clot. The blood clot that can happen in the artery system is also different than calcium. The artery system can get a blood clot that suddenly comes down in it, and it lodges in that road, and that patient knows that they have a blood clot in their leg within that day or the next day, because it is severe pain. It is sudden pain. It's a difference in how you were that morning. It's a difference how you were than the day before. And that is called a thromboembolic clot, or an arterial embolic event. I know those words, what I'll say is that that is a sudden event, a piece of clot breaking off from somewhere in your body, usually the heart, or from the main vessel in the body called the aorta. It travels down and it lodges somewhere in your legs. And suddenly, over an hour, you feel different. Your leg is swollen. It is cool to touch. Sometimes even perishingly cold is what we'll say that we touch. And it's cold like ice. And then you start to lose all the power that you had. You realize that you're not moving your toes. You're not moving your ankle as much. And patients have to come to hospital right away, because it is usually an artery clot that has formed. And I don't want to create an alarm. This is very rare. I've only seen a few since I've been back from training, so it's not common. So I think the caller might be calling, that he might be on blood thinners. For one of those two, if it were my guess, it would probably be a clot in the deep vein system, or deep venous thrombosis, which you're on blood clots, blood thinners for. I think one of the questions you asked, caller, was, does that have anything to do with the buildup of calcium? No, not directly. But what I'd say is that most patients that I'm going to do a procedure on, I put them on a blood thinner. Not usually the strong ones like warfarin, or the newer ones now that we have like Xarelto or Pradaxa. Those are some of the newer brand name ones. I'll put them on a smaller, more mild blood thinner like aspirin or clopidogrel. That's just a little bit of extra information there. But not clots are not usually related to the same condition that we're talking about here. Sorry, that was a bit much, and if it was quite wordy, sorry about that.
Let me interrupt Dr. Graniston again, because there's another gentleman that wants to have a word with you, Dr. Yap. Good evening, sir.
Yes, good evening. I'm having some pain in my hip I think they do the back. I know the back of my I'm a lower back and lower back of hip. I wonder if that could have anything to do with poor circulation. Sometimes I'm getting a little problem, little pain once a month or so in my side. Could that happen to the poor circulation?
My gut thing is potentially, yes. That's obviously over the phone, that could potentially have some poor circulation. The hip one, I wasn't so sure, so I was listening to you. But when you said the thigh, my ears peaked a bit more like maybe that is the buttock and thigh clotting. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I'm going to doctor later. We'll talk about that this Monday.
Yeah, you can bring it up and just say, listen, I was just wondering if this could be a cause. And if your doctor... almost every doctor will know how to check the pulses in the groin, and then they'll check behind your knee and they'll check lower down. I think that's a very reasonable question to ask. And I think it's very important that as a patient, you feel that you can ask your doctor things or bring up things and learn about things both ways. So I think it's very reasonable. And my gut instinct says, yes, that needs to be looked into further.
Thanks.
All right, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you kindly. And before you get back to your... get back to Dr. Graniston, let me ask you this, or rather read this to you, because this person is saying to you, I don't know if this point was dealt with since I was away from the radio a bit, but the question is, what really causes the buildup of excess calcium?
Very good question, and scientists continue to look into that as research goes on. The main thing I would say is genetics. The reason I say that first is because you unfortunately can't change how you're born or your ancestry line. And so genetics plays a huge role in it. You could be the healthiest person in the world, whatever that looks like nowadays. There's so many different recommendations, as a couple callers before said. And you could do everything, let's say, quote unquote, right, and you can still have poor circulation. And you see that in Asian populations, and you see that in the Barbadian population. And I say that not to scare anybody, but I think it's so important that we as a population know what we're dealing with. I was in Australia recently, and they have a native or indigenous population. They're called the Aboriginal population. And their blockages of their arteries are so bad as well. And that comes in from thousands of years, or hundreds of years from their ancestry line. And so how you're born and what your genetic makeup is, you can't change. So that's one. Number two is high blood pressure or hypertension and diabetes and cholesterol. Those three things definitely directly contribute to how fast your calcium can continue to build up. And so the management of those things, if you have any of those three, high blood pressure, diabetes, or high cholesterol, those are so important to control. A vascular doctor can do surgery and do this fancy bypass that I talked about. But without those three things being, if you have any one of those three things or all three of those things, which a lot of patients have, those three things really have to be as on point as they can be for any part of your poor circulation to slow down as much as possible. Smoking directly as well. I sort of put smoking in a different category because we look at high blood pressure, diabetes, and high cholesterol as those sort of, you know, non-communicable diseases that are so topical in a population. I put smoking in a category by itself because I think you can control if you smoke or not. So I know that's difficult for very strong smokers, but smoking is a separate category. But it is so important that with your polyclinic doctor or your GP doctor to really get on top of your high blood pressure, your diabetes, and your cholesterol. Because outside of those, any sort of new or contemporary medicine or surgery, is going to not be as good for you as it could be. And there's a chance that you could avoid ever having to get to a vascular surgeon. That's the idea, is that you hopefully never have to actually meet me. That's the whole point of this, is that, you know, I'm sort of the other end of the spectrum. I want that every patient that has poor circulation or found out they have poor circulation hopefully never has to meet me for an operation like a bypass or for angioplasty of the legs.
All right, Dr. Grenison, you're due.
Okay, great. So thank you so much, Dr. Yap. I think that we've had really some good explanations in terms of what you need to be mindful of as you go forward. And certainly with the high blood pressure, as we call it here locally, or the high blood sugar, both of these conditions can directly damage the vessels, which then start or progress or increase the chances of that calcium buildup in the actual vessel. But I wanted to really now to go on to the side of PAD that we don't like to speak about and really explain to patients why we need to intervene early and why we would want you to intervene early as a medical practitioner. We know that historically Barbados was known as the amputation capital of the world. And so with persons having progressive disease, which is not caught early enough, as you stated, it moves now from that rest pain or that nocturnal pain that the patient is having to actually having an acute episode where suddenly, as you spoke about or you alluded to, the foot goes cold, perishingly cold. Tell us about some of those other symptoms that the patient can appreciate, and then speak about what essentially can happen and why we don't want it to happen. Give us some evidence in terms of some of the scary statistics, because I think that that's important sometimes, so that patients know this is really not where I would want to be. So tell us about that.
Yeah, and undoubtedly, and I think it's very topical that unfortunately a lot of Barbadians end up with what we call major limb amputations, which is an amputation below the knee or above the knee. That's where they're traditionally done, depending on if it's infection or if there's bad blockage. And it's a horrible thing to think of, but that's a very commonly where a lot of our patients end up with peripheral arterial disease. In terms of the what can we do to avoid it, and that's where I come in. Like I said, I'm sort of down at the end of the line, so it's so important that there's so many other people involved, and hopefully before the patient has to meet me, because when you're meeting me, we're probably past the point of high blood pressure and diabetes control. When you're probably coming to a vascular unit or a vascular surgery, you're looking to get the blood back into the leg. That is done as a bypass, as we chatted about, making that new highway. Or there's a more modern way, which is angioplasty. A lot of patients have heard it for the heart, but then they can get it for the leg. So I make a small puncture in the groin, and I send down very small wires. And then we try to inflate a balloon or blow up a balloon to widen that part of the artery that's blocked. And then that balloon comes out of the body. Sometimes I leave a stent, like a little metal or titanium stent, to try to open up that and keep it open. Those are all relatively temporary measures. They might work for a few months, maybe a few years, but it's not as good as your own arteries or your own veins. Undoubtedly, I've had to meet patients where those things are not an option. And that's very hard for me as a vascular surgeon to say the bypass or the angioplasty will not do you justice, will not do you service. And then we're talking about an amputation. I'll be honest, the statistics of being the amputation capital in the world are flawed, but we need stronger statistics to disprove it since that study was made a few years ago. But I know that everyone knows this and that amputations are done very often for really bad infections. But I'll be honest, as you said, I've worked at the QEH for a long time. And so I know when patients come in, unfortunately, most patients are coming in with the infection fairly bad. It's, you know, potentially up from the toe to the ankle or even the leg. And sometimes I have to tell patients and family, we don't have a choice here. We're not talking about bypass or angioplasty. We have to talk about saving your life and getting you back home with your family. And those are always very tough decisions and discussions for any surgeon, especially in the surgery unit. It's very hard discussions for me because this is my specialty. But at the end of the day, it has to be the patient's life, and obviously with their consent over everything else. But the reality is there are many amputees in Barbados. But the reason, and I'll be honest, the reason I was sent to do vascular surgery, it was the government of Barbados that saw a need for it, and the Ministry of Health 5 years ago when I was still training as a surgeon. They had discussions with me and they said, we need to do vascular surgery. We need a vascular surgeon. We need to decrease the amount of amputations happening in Barbados. And that is unquestionable. And so I was sent to do vascular surgery. And it's not about one person. It's about everyone from your medical practitioners to GPs to nutritionists to wound care nurses. It's so important, the kind of wound care that you're getting at the polyclinics or the hospital, which are so, they have so many dressings to do, but wound care matters so much. Your medication that you're on matters so much if it's the right medication for you. And the surgery that you hopefully could get from me is honestly, hopefully at the end. And that, you know, probably hopefully you don't need me, like I said before. They're probably, and anyone that has poor artery supply or poor circulation, there are probably seven people that, you know, should be working on you in a way: a wound care nurse, a nutritionist, your GP, me. Just, it's a whole network, it's a whole ecosystem that needs to breathe and think of your circulation, and because the end goal is for you to save your leg, save your foot, and be as much as you can a contributing member to the society. That's the whole reason to save a limb and to save a leg, is so that you can be working, you can be contributing, you can spend, you know, you're living the quality of life that you want. And that's what the whole program for vascular surgery in Barbados is, will hopefully be about.
All right, Doctor, I think we had a caller. Let's see if he is still there. And it was a gentleman, by the way.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, that's fine. Let's see if the, hello?
Hey, Greg Sten, I'm here.
Oh, so this is a different caller now. It was a gentleman before. You're having a plethora of gentlemen calling you. Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Yes. Yes, please. They can hear you. Go ahead.
I have a question. Does high calcium level has any relations to thyroid problems?
I'll answer that. I'll probably do it to Dr. Granison to answer because she's so more up to date on thyroid than me. But yes, there is a correlation between thyroid issues and hyper or high calcium in the body. But if you're looking for more information, I'll be very honest, caller. My knowledge on that is a little bit older, but I don't know if Dr. Granison wants to comment on that.
Well, yes, it can be related to the thyroid and more importantly, the parathyroid, which are some of the actual smaller organs located to the back of that thyroid gland. But it is really a conversation because it can get very, very intricate, certainly parathyroid disease, for you to have a very detailed conversation with your physician. But to answer that in short, the answer to that is yes, it can. There is a relation.
Thank you very much.
All right.
You're most welcome.
Thank you kindly. You have a good evening. Before we disappear from here, Doc, there are one or two WhatsApp that I want to share with you very quickly. This one's here for quite a while. It says, has there been any research done to compare blockages on vegans versus meat eaters? That's one. I don't know if you wish to respond or wish to hear the others. You tell me what you want me to do.
So Gregson, you can just let's get all of them
right,
so that
okay.
In these last 4 minutes, Nina can make optimal use of time.
All right. Would crossing your leg while sitting contribute to the blocking of veins/arteries? I think that was the second one. Was there a third one? I think there was a third one. This one says, good night to the goodly doctors. If you are taking 1-alpha-N calcium carbonate 1 a day, can it cause a buildup of calcium in your body? Those are your three queries.
Great, thanks, Rex. I'll answer them quickly so that everyone hopefully gets to have their answer. I'm going to use Dr. Granison's expertise and defer number three because the truth is I don't know. I'm always very honest when I'm not sure. For number one, really interesting question, vegans versus meat eaters, is there any scientific evidence about the buildup of calcium? I'll say not that I'm aware of, but that is a very interesting space for sort of clean eating. Is the cholesterol pathway slowed down or even reversed in vegans? So what I'll say, there's no concrete level one. And when we say level one, we mean it's the highest evidence in science. So there's no level one evidence I'm aware of to say that vegans produce or little or less calcium than meat eaters. But what I will say is that there is a lot of research going into, yes, meat products and the sort of obviously the different diet that a plant-based diet will have versus people who are eating meats but I don't know of any concrete level one evidence. Mm-hmm. Number two, the crossing your legs question, can it lead to problems with the arteries or the veins? So not with the arteries. There's been no proven link with crossing your legs causing issues with blood going down to your legs. But interestingly, with the return of blood, because the leg that you lap over the other leg, you are theoretically compressing that vein a little bit. So if, like, let's say you cross your right leg over your left, it is possible that that right vein behind the knee is compressed a bit more and therefore the blood pools down in the leg and the feet a bit more. Again, any best evidence like level one that we call no, again, not that I'm aware of, but theoretically and physics, we kind of do say that. So when I have patients that have vein problems, and not just varicose veins, but like venous ulcers, which are a lot of QEH as well that I see in our clinic, I would often encourage them to not cross their legs. But that's sort of a intuitive sort of physics thoughts on it. Dr. Granis, I don't know if you want to talk about the helpful question.
What I'm going to do is that I'm going to answer it very quickly because I do not know of 1N calcium. I know usually most calcium supplementation is usually in the form of calcium carbonate, calcium citrate. Sometimes we can even use calcium gluconate and calcium lactate in our calcium supplementation, but I am not aware of such. So to answer that question, I would say I would have to research it a bit more. And possibly if Gregson, you can save that question and send it to me and I can do my research because there's a whole set of research that we are always doing, and maybe I can answer that question next week. Well, but seeing that we are, go ahead.
Yeah, you might have to research this one as well too, just in case, because they ask me. This is the last one. I won't keep you back any longer. This last one says, where is it? Just had it here. Oh yes, here we go. It says amyloids. Come. Yeah, here we go. Does amyloids have anything to do with calcium buildup? Amyloids, they said.
Amyloids, in terms of like if a patient has amyloidosis, which is more so in keeping with a protein, that's usually a misfolding of a protein itself, but usually not really associated with calcium deposition. It's more so a misfolding of a protein. And that in itself can cause problems. We see it, for instance, with Alzheimer's disease, where you have amyloid plaques being developed. And there are other conditions that you can have amyloid deposition about the body. But as far as I am aware, if that is what they're speaking about, then the answer to that is no.
All right. Yeah, finish. Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I just wanted to take, because I know that we're now behind the hour, I just want to take...
That's quite all right.
Nina, if there's one thing you could share with our listeners this evening as a take-home point, what would it be in terms of helping patients to be more empowered, one, but also from a preventative standpoint in terms of how best to try to mitigate the chances of having very severe disease in terms of disease presentation, so that they can enjoy a good quality of life?
Oh, it's a great question. And I wish I had a really easy answer. What I'd say is don't ignore it. You know that if your legs are changing over time, and no one knows your body more than you. And so if you tell your GP or polyclinic doctor that, listen, I could walk that bus stop between bus stops fine 2 years ago, something's changing. So be in tune with your body, which you already are. When you go to your GP, you know, and most GPs will do it, but let them check your leg, especially as a diabetic or hypertensive. Let them check your pulses. Let them look between your toes. Let them do those small tests that can find something quite early. I think that's probably, if I were to say one thing, is letting the doctor check for the pulses and checking for any early signs of darkening of the toes, or shiny legs when you're losing hair. Those are subtle signs. I think actually you asked me that earlier, which I probably should have. I'm only right now thinking of, but those are subtle signs that you are getting poor circulation, that kind of hair loss, shiny appearance of the legs, and that sort of cramping in the legs over the same distance all the time that you realize is new. And I think early recognition. And I think there is a way for this to change around and turn around. It will take some time, and it will take a massive effort on everyone. But yeah, I think I can see it already in the polyclinics, and I see people being really good about their blood pressure and their diabetes. I don't want to talk too long, but yeah, I just think controlling those things that you can control, accepting the ones that you can't, and the genetics are there. We know that already. And let's do everything we can to avoid anything major happening, and hoping to have the best quality of life and an active life as possible.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Yap, for taking this opportunity to come out and talk to us this evening, talking about peripheral arterial disease. I must also congratulate and thank our men for participating so nicely this evening. I think Gregson was even a little shocked at the amount of male callers that we had this evening. I am very proud of you guys.
Yes,
I am very proud of them. And I want to say stay tuned next week when we return again on Better Health Radio Show. Gregson, I turn over to you. Thanks a lot, Dr. Yap.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Gregson. Thanks, Dr. Grandison. Wonderful to be here.
Right. Thank you all. There you go. That's Dr. Nina Yap, the guest this evening on the Better Health Radio Show. And, of course, your host this evening, Dr. Adana Grandison. Of course, next weekend, 6 o'clock, you'll come back again for another edition of the Better Health Radio Show. Thanks to all of you, and have a wonderful evening. And, yes, we will be sending you that question you asked me to in a matter of seconds. Thanks, Docs. Take care. Have a good evening.